Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
おやさん、言うといたるがの。 わしの目の黒いやつは絶対やらしませんで。調子に乗りやがって。ええ加減にせえよ。銭になりもせんことしやがって。そんな気づかせんのもええですけ。かばんから持っとけ。これはな、今のわしにできる精一杯のことじゃ。土井は死んだと。 これから山守組の天下じゃ。堺のてっちゃん帰ってきたし、わしの役目はもう終わった。こんなには悪いが、わしは山守組を離れて旅へ出るわ。
兄貴、山守を助けとるのはあんたじゃけ。堺が帰った言うて関係ないじゃない。今まで通り追ってやってつかいや。
To the Projection Booth. I'm Rob St. Mary, and joining me is co-host Mike White.
Howdy, hey.
And our old friend and Japanese film expert Coffin John from the V Cinema Podcast is also joining us today.
Howdy, everyone, and thanks again for asking me on the show, guys.
This week, we're looking at Kenji Fukuzaku's Battles Without Honor and Humanity. Directed by Fukuzaku, who we talked about a few months ago when we highlighted Battle Royale, Battles Without Honor and Humanity tells the tale of Japanese gangs in Hiroshima after the end of World War II to 1970. The first film, released in 1973, was followed by four additional parts before the whole series wound up in 1974. Much like Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather saga, Fukuzaku's films follows a main character, Shozo Hirano, played by Sugawara Bunta, who fights his way through the post-war slums of Hiroshima to become a leading Yakuza gangster in the city. Fukuzaku's style layers in very noirish themes at times and frenzied camera work to help show the chaos these characters create within their lives and the backdrop of Japan's post-war rebirth. Of course, there's a lot more to it, and that's why we're talking about it today. So, fellas, these films came onto your radar when? I know for me, it all started with my dad just buying the box set that came out a few years ago on a lark. He was in my old employer video store par excellence, Thomas Video, as we often talk about here in the Detroit area, and was just talking to the owners about what to get me for a gift. It was either my birthday or Christmas or something. And they pointed to the Battles Without Honor and Humanity box set. And that was my introduction actually to not only Fukuzaku's gangsters, but also Fukuzaku himself. And I have to say, I've been very amazed and impressed and hooked on this box set, these films, and his work ever since I was introduced. So, Mike, what about you?
Well, yeah, it seems like we've had a real renaissance of Yakuza films over the last, well, geez, I'd say maybe a decade. I mean, just looking at my bookshelf today, it's like, you know, the Yakuza movie book, the Tokyo Scope book has a big chapter on Yakuza. And it's just like, it was funny because there really haven't been a whole lot of forays into mainstream American movies from the whole Yakuza angle. I mean, we had Black Rain and we had the forgettable Paul Schrader film Yakuza, but otherwise it really came to the fore. I mean, I guess just with you know, the DVDs kind of coming more and becoming more popular, just stuff kind of escaping from Japan and getting into the American consciousness. I don't know, what do you think, John?
Well, yeah, I think that's part of it. And actually, I kind of like Paul Schrader's film, you know, to be honest. But I'll go into my experience. I think I was first exposed to Battles Without Honor and Humanity through the film's ephemera rather than the film itself. I started seriously studying Japanese and you know, Japanese culture, et cetera, society in the mid-80s. And the film had such great cultural impact in Japan at that time and, you know, even now, you know, that references to the film were and still are everywhere in pop culture. So that's everything from the battles like Yakuza films that are now, you know, part of the direct-to-video genre, I guess you could say, and, you know, variants of the film's title used both seriously and in parody. So, you know, it's not Battles Without Honor and Humanity, but it's something like I saw, I think it was supposed to be a comic book or of some sort. I saw something that said Battles Without Food. So they just replaced the word basically to sort of parody the title of the film. And as well, the opening fanfare of Toshiaki Tsushima's theme song for the film is basically instantly recognized among all Japanese people. It's used in Japanese TV very frequently. As for the film itself, I think I actually saw it sometime in the mid-90s, and I think it was when I was living in Hawaii at the time as an undergrad. But for sure, it wasn't my first Yakuza film. I'd seen, you know, Kurosawa's Drunken Angel, you know, which some way may argue is not a Yakuza film to begin with. But, you know, besides that, I would say that I'd seen other Yakuza films before Battles, but through a lot of them, you know, you can tell the comparative quality of the Battles series, especially this first installment.
When we talk about Fukuzaku and Japanese film of the period around this time in the early 70s, I mean, was this a genre? Was this something that was starting to come into its own as maybe how there had been, you know, the monster films or the samurai films? Sort of how do you see it when you sort of look at the timeline of Japanese film around that era?
When you talk about Yakuza film, there's really a wide range of films of that genre. And, you know, we're using genre, I think, here in quotes, because it's not really so much a genre, but because there's such a wide range, I guess we have to consider it that way. You know, Yakuza film came into, I would say, how do you say it? It came into prominence, I would say, sometime in the 40s and 50s with what the films are generally called the Ninkyo Eiga films, which are films that actually portray Yakuza as sort of almost like heroes. They definitely portray them in a much more cavalier and chivalrous sort of manner than the Yakuza that we're going to talk about with Battles Without Honor and Humanity, as well as the later direct-to-video Yakuza films, which, you know, whatever you probably deal with at some other later date. But a lot of these films, what they did was they were popular among the greater audience. But I think as Fukuzaku had seen them, you know, he saw these films probably as well as a lot of other directors who handled these later era films, saw these films as being kind of like a sham. It was basically portraying the Yakuza as these great honorable people when in fact they as Fukusaku and his peers knew them as being very scummy, you know, for the money type of people who would basically kill anyone who would get in their way. So I think Fukusaku's take on this genre is very much a reaction to both what was happening at the time and all the films, the Yakuza films that were presented in the past.
Well, I kind of handled it in the beginning a little bit about sort of how the story kind of plays out. And that's really sort of a, you know, the TV Guide, like one sentence synopsis for basically all five films. But as for this movie as a whole, kind of getting into the particulars of it, what kind of things do you find really interesting in terms of like how this thing is plotted and how it plays along?
Well, personally, I like to see the way that it plays against history. I mean, the whole thing starts with this shot of a mushroom cloud. I mean, and that awesome music, as John was talking about, and just kind of, you know, it's almost startling, that music as it comes up, and it's just this shrill kind of, you know, the sound, and then the image, of course, is very powerful. And you see really how everything plays against history as they go through. And there are little, almost like little breaks where it's like, you know, this person was killed on this day. And they're very particular about, you know, what day and date it was when this certain thing happens. And for me, you know, I know you had mentioned The Godfather a little bit ago, and The Godfather definitely does play against history quite a bit too. I mean, we've got, you know, post-war with Michael Corleone coming back and all of this kind of stuff. And just the way that we see American history change as the movies go along. But this one, it really reminded me a lot, or I should say that I can see where Scorsese took a lot from this film as far as, you know, the photo montages. I mean, when they, I'm trying to remember exactly what happens, but when the U.S. goes to war against Korea, it was like a boom time for these Yakuza, and they have this whole like little photo montage of them having these great times and, you know, partying and all this kind of stuff. Totally reminded me of when Karen is talking about how they would vacation and they would have those little photo montages of the Henry and Karen and all the other gangsters in Goodfellas. And I thought that it was really kind of neat to see where Scorsese had gotten a lot of his inspiration. And it just kind of shows how, you know, eclectic he is in his taste.
I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of the visual ideas of what Fukusaku does. One thing I noticed is that he has this tendency within scenes to almost go tableau, where he puts as many faces in the image that he can in this widescreen image. And the one that really comes out to me is where there's this whole sort of like saving face issue, and the character played by Bunta has to cut his finger off and then send it to the boss, the other boss, is, you know, I'm sorry, I apologize for getting a little loud with your guy. And there's about 8 or 9 faces in this shot. He has this real knack for composition that if you look at it in a way, it's staged, but at the same time, it doesn't feel staged. So I was trying to see what other things do you see for him as a director in terms of how he uses the frame, even also what we talked about in the front end with the use of this chaotic camera in order to bring out the violence and the chaos with the handheld. What do you sort of see as his sort of visual sense and things that you really liked in terms of the look of the film in that way?
Fukusaku is associated with a genre. Again, we're using genre in loose terms here, but he's associated with a genre known as the Jitsuroku Rosen Yakuza Eiga, which basically means like it's a Yakuza film, but it's based on real accounts. And, you know, again, this is contrasting with earlier efforts in Yakuza film, which were, again, more like fantasy-like in that they portrayed Yakuza as being these sort of heroic, chivalrous, you know, gallant types who were more like Robin Hood types, I would say. You know, they were still criminals, but they were still, you know, doing it for the good of the people, right? And that's not entirely fictitious, by the way, I should say. But the way Fukusaku approached Yakuza film was to, again, show that Yakuza were not as great, gallant, and chivalrous. And in fact, The theme of the film, which in Japanese is Jingi Naki Tatakai, Battles Without Honor and Humanity, is the literal translation. One of the linguistic elements that's missing from that translation, unfortunately, is this concept of jingi, which is actually the Japanese characters are honor humanity together. And this concept of jingi is supposed to be this thing among yakuza, which was sort of like a samurai code of sorts. So when they approach something, approach a situation, you know, they would think that, you know, they don't want to, for example, hurt innocent bystanders. They don't want to get involved with drugs. They don't want to, of course, besmirch the name of the Yakuza, you know, so they had this sort of bound, honor-bound code, supposedly. And the Jingi Naki Tatakai, again, that's a Japanese title, is basically means that these Yakuza, these modern Yakuza, or maybe these Yakuza throughout time, have never worked under any kind of honorable code, that they just take what they want. And if you're in their way, they're going to basically step on you like a cockroach, let's say. And I think that Fukusaku's style is very much in the vein of trying to capture that sort of mindset. You know, the handheld camera work, for example, the extreme Dutch angles, you know, these really oblique angles they use is showing that, you know, the world is not this wonderful, straight, you know, symmetrical thing. It's this crazy place that's run by these, you know, evil Yakuza. So, you know, watch yourself, that kind of thing.
I really like the chaos of the camera, especially in the opening. I mean, just that kind of the whole group of everyone there, kind of this post-war, almost like a camp where everyone's at, and just the absolute insanity of that. I mean, people running through the crowd and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it really comes through very well in the way that he shoots that.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, the camera operator was a wartime documentarian of some sort. I can't quite recall. I had read something that said something that he had chronicled maybe World War II, and just he knew how to use that camera. So Fukusaku used him for that reason.
He does do some really fascinating stuff with the camera. I mean, there, Rob was alluding to some of the framing. I mean, I do enjoy the way that there is at least one scene where a character is facing towards us, the viewer, while everyone else is talking. But that person who is facing towards us, who is closest to the camera, is completely out of focus while everyone else is in focus. And it's just kind of like, maybe you shouldn't put all your trust into this person because he is so out of focus in this scene. And then eventually he does come back into the fold. He turns around and is back in focus with the rest of them, but it kind of gives you that nice visual metaphor for not trusting this person maybe as much as you probably should. And I should probably say too, I'm not coming to this as someone who's seen it quite a few times. I know Rob has seen this a few times. I know John has seen this a few times. Me, I'm coming to this and I'm just like trying to make sense of this movie. I will say that as an outsider, it is very densely layered and there is this whole sense of history to things. And there are so many different clans that are happening. I mean, it was, for me, I had to watch this quite a few times before I think I even really started to understand what the heck was going on with this movie. So if there are listeners out there who do try to take this movie on and they don't get it the first time, don't feel bad. Don't feel alone. I was right there with you.
Right. And I think it's really telling that in the box set that I believe is HVE put out for the entire main series, that they included an insert with basically who gets whacked and in which episode of the series, you know. So it's this long, like almost like family line of Yakuza and who gets killed and when and by whom, you know. So it's really humorous in that manner, but also very serious too, because, you know, as we all know, you know, organized crime is very serious business. And I do emphasize the word business here because I think that there's this misconception that a lot of organized crime is there for, you know, killing people and all that. And yes, there is killing, of course, you know, let's not get beyond that. But, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, now in Japan are very legitimate businessmen. You know, they're not, there are still, you know, these kind of thug like Yakuza running around in Japan. But the real dangerous Yakuza, some of them are people who are serving on, you know, boards and stuff like that of, you know, major companies and corporations and have very vested interests in society as well as, you know, making money for themselves as a whole.
as you were saying, in terms of the convolution of this, the I love the flow chart that comes with the box set. So yeah. It's one of my favorite pieces that goes along with any box set that I've ever had. The thing also that I wanted to talk about with this in terms of the violence aspect is every death throughout the film and then throughout the entire series is, as you said, it's marked. It's like there's a date. This is who it is. And there's this score piece that comes up that plays every single time. It's the exact same piece of music with every single death. And sort of wanted to get your take on that. I mean, I know for me personally, if I could have someone play that at the moment of my death, I'd be very excited. But but what is sort of your take on this idea that, you know, he like pauses it, he like freezes the frame, the title comes up, the music swells, and then bam, we're back into the story. I mean, to me, I sort of see them as sort of like chapter heads. I sort of see them as markers throughout the story that kind of guide us through, so that way we can help to make sense of it. Because I think from my take, Fukuzaku understood that he was dealing with a very dense, character heavy, you know, film.
And also, if you recall, when we talked about Battle Royale, he used a very similar technique to sort of, you know, highlight the death of, you know, main characters in the story. I think on one level, it was just Fukuzaku understanding, you know, the denseness of, you know, hey, the audience might forget who this person is, so let me flash it on to make sure they remember. But in a way, I think it has a collateral effect of sort of bringing a sort of sense of humanness back into the situation. Because, I mean, certainly you could lump Battles Without Honor and Humanity into sort of a sort of action genre sort of mode, in that, you know, there are guns being fired off, there is stabbing, there is running around. That kind of thing. But I think that, you know, having that each death being marked, it kind of brings back that sort of, yes, this is a human too. You know, it's almost like a tombstone, you could say, I guess. You know, it's being a little artsy, maybe, but a little tombstone within the film saying, you know, hey, here lies this person. You know, he was a human, even if he was a complete scumbag, you know, as a film character anyway, right? So that's what my kind of take on that.
I guess going back to what we talked about with Battle Royale, you know, we had talked about the island from Battle Royale as being this kind of microcosm of Japan and different characters standing for different facets of Japanese society. And I was wondering what you guys were thinking as far as with the Yakuza and how they were kind of standing in for different elements of Japanese society too. I mean, you know, just that it starts with the, you know, atomic bomb explosion and everything going from that. I mean, what kind of historical spin is being put onto this? And I know spin is kind of a bad word for this, but what kind of spin is being put onto this as far as post-war Japan goes?
If you look at Japanese film, like the complete history of Japanese film, and, you know, there's lots of films that are missing. So unfortunately, we shouldn't really say incomplete history of Japanese film. To me, I would say there are three major events that really determined the direction in which Japan and therefore Japanese film would take. One of them is the war. There's no, you know, doubt about that. There's one earlier, probably the Meiji Restoration was a big one that I think a lot of films at that era addressed. And, you know, now, just last year, we had the great earthquake and tsunami in Tohoku. That's going to be a very, very big indicator of what's to come as far as the arts and film are concerned, in my opinion. Of course, that hasn't played out just yet. So going back to World War II, you know, I think more so than, of course, Fukuzaku is trying to portray or show what's happening during the immediate post-war, which is, you know, we have this, the whole country's in chaos, you know, all these people are fighting for, you know, what, you know, little scraps that are left for them. You know, the military is still here. The military is still under control. You know, the U.S. military, of course. But really, you know, I think he's using the gangsters as a sort of cipher for Japanese society. And the reason why I mention this is, and I'm going to try to mention this without spoiling the whole thing, but if you look at the gangsters in the film and their hierarchy, you know, we can see, you know, their bosses, then underbosses, then there are the, you know, the thugs, the chimpira, as they're called in Japanese, the kind of the nobody thugs that have to basically work their way up to the top, those kinds of people, if they can make it to the top, you know, without being killed. You know, as the film plays out, you realize that the people in the Yakuza organization who are in power, who are they? Well, they are these two people, Yamamori and Makihara. And really, what have they done to the Yakuza organization as a whole within the film? They've basically worked in their own best interest the whole time. They basically selfishly said, you know, to the underlings, you do the work, you know, you kill this person, you kill this person, you know, I don't have enough money to be able to pay for you, you know, you go to jail for me, you take the fall for me, this kind of thing. And who are the guys who end up sort of, in a way, screwed in the end? Are these underling guys. And I think if you think about it really closely, you know, Fukusaka, I think, was really trying to use these guys as a cipher for the Japanese social system, you know, and this was his critique against the war, was that, hey, we have these government figures, these guys who work in their own best interest to get money for themselves to basically make us their pawns. I think that's where we can see, you know, a lot of film scholars, as well as just Japanese film fans in general, talk about Fukusaku's anger and disillusionment, which is reflected in this film. And I think that's basically the embodiment of his anger and disillusionment, that he realized that, you know, he was born into this society that basically, in essence, lied to him, that said, you know, you're not one of us. You are one of the underlings, you know, and you do our bidding, that kind of thing. Fukusaka, I don't think had much real interest in Yakuza, because I think he gets like some of the stuff a little bit. I don't want to say incorrect so much, but he sort of fudges some of the, you know, more ritualized aspects of the Yakuza. I think he sort of makes up his own little thing, or just takes things from hearsay some of the times. But I think the most important thing is that, you know, he's using these thematic elements in a lot of his films, you know, dating back to films like, you know, Blackmail Is My Business, If You Were Young, Rage, and then even to films like, you know, as we mentioned, Battle Royale. But, you know, there's this concept of, you know, this rage or this anger against society. And I don't think, you know, and let's get this straight, though. You know, Fukusaku was a commercial filmmaker. You know, he was probably one of the most successful post-war filmmakers, especially as a genre film director, you know, primarily in the early 70s and late 60s. But, you know, even so, he had enough of a voice to be able to use these sort of anti-authoritarian themes in his films, you know, which to me is what, when I think of Fukusaka, what makes him so good as a director.
It's interesting that you bring up the ceremonies of the Yakuza, which this is once again this visual that Mike was talking about with the use of stills. You see it a little bit in this one, but it does become more pronounced later in the series than the other films, in that you get the feeling that either he's bored by the rituals and doesn't want to like glamorize them. Could be the other thing, where instead of like in some of the other, I would say like American gangster films or things like that, we're very much present with the gangsters and we live their lives with them. And especially these like, you know, oh, you're going to be a made man and all this kind of stuff, right, where, you know, this is a great thing. So we're going to show it in all of its, you know, glamour. With Fukusaku, he's very much like, all right, here's a few stills and a couple of titles and bam, we're back into the story. So I don't get the feeling throughout these films, and especially this one, that he wants to glamorize this lifestyle at all. He just finds them to be interesting characters and he wants us to spend some time with them so that maybe we can understand various things and maybe understand in some way, as we were talking about with the history that this covers, basically sort of 25 years from 1945-46 to 1970, that there was this illegal hand, this black hand per se, that was involved in the rebirth of the country, that their hand, that the gangsters, the underbelly of society was propping up things, you know, to make things like the Korean War happen or to help the government in terms of who would get elected and how they would get elected, or when the Olympics comes, I think that's in one of the other stories, like how that all happens and who makes money. So he wants to sort of expose the seedy underbelly of society in some way, but he doesn't want you to live with them and go, isn't that a great thing? He wants to make sort of a counter comment on them.
Right. And I think that Fukusaku, just like any other modern Japanese at the time, was very much realized that, you know, the Yakuza were a part of the rebuilding effort. You know, part of that being that, you know, they were able to get contracts, you know, through probably less than legal means from the U.S. government and other organizations. And I think that you can see that happen again if you look at last year's Tohoku recovery effort from the earthquake and the tsunami. It's been reported a little bit, at least two or three times I've seen articles where it's been reported that Yakuza have been involved in getting contracts in the rebuilding effort. So it's almost like, I think that, you know, if Fukusaku had been able to survive just a few years longer, you know, I believe he passed away in 2002 or three, I can't remember exactly, but he could probably see this sort of happen all over again. You know, it's like, hey, you know, of course, this is all in hindsight and it's all sort of conjecture and all that stuff. But, you know, here we go. And here we go. Another major giant incident. And hey, here are the Yakuza again, you know, and it's sort of like history repeating itself, you know, and it's all by coincidence, of course, you know, but still, you know, I think that he would maybe sort of think back and say, like, yeah, Battles Without Honor and Humanity. Remember that? Here it is again.
Earlier this year, we covered Kenji Fukusaku's Battle Royale and spoke with the subtitler, Linda Hoagland. At that time, we also talked to her about Battles Without Honor and Humanity, which she also translated. We're going to take a break and we'll be back in a few with that interview and more on the projection booth.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
And I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. Yeah. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
We interrupt your podcastual programming for this HollywoodLeak.com news break. Here's the latest from HollywoodLeak.com. OWN network tanking. Oprah wants her cars back. Seal grows mustache, changes his name to Walrus. And a quick pilot casting update. You didn't get it. Entertainment news is always leaking. For these stories and more, go to HollywoodLeak.com.
You know, Fukusaku is famous for his gangster films, kind of culminating in Battle Royale. But Battle Royale, if you look at that, it really shows you that he's not so much, the action is always driven by rage. And it's about rage against, well, I guess in this day you'd call it rage against the machine. But it's, you know, the rage began when he was 15 and he, like all teenagers in Japan during the war, was working for a munitions factory and the American ships started to bomb the factory. So it fell to him and his friends to pick up all the body pieces of all the workers that had been killed. So, you know, it's sort of, he was 15 in 1945. So he had believed all the Japanese war propaganda until then. And then sort of that moment was the beginning of his awakening that, you know, it was all a big lie. And then, of course, he, along with Oshima and then the Japanese photographer Tomatsu, they were all 15 in 1945. And so they all learned that in the ensuing years that everything they had been taught by their parents had been a lie about liberating East Asia, et cetera, et cetera. And then the Americans came in and promised democracy. And then in 1948, they were like, actually, maybe not. And there was something called reverse course, where basically the Red Scare started to take hold, and that really colored the occupation policy. And so all the New Dealers, the idealistic New Dealers, were driven out. And suddenly China was the new enemy. And so, in other words, I guess I'm just trying to say that his artistic vision is very much, the origins of his artistic vision have very much to do with the war and the end of the war and the lies that were fed them. And Under the Flag of the Rising Sun, he was co-director. After Kurosawa got kicked off of Tora 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 as the Japanese director, Fukasaku took over, and he was paid handsomely as a director's fee. So he used that money and optioned a nonfiction book about the actual horrible conditions that Japanese soldiers were made to endure during World War II, and he fictionalized it into a brilliant indictment of militarism in this searing film called Under the Flag of the Rising Sun, in which there are no gangsters. But Battle Royale and Under the Flag of the Rising Sun were the only two films that he optioned with his own money. And so in that sense, those are the two films that represent his core artistic vision. So his gangster films are driven by that rage, but as he said to me before he passed away, I'm not all that interested in gangsters themselves, which is why I think in Battles Without Honor and Humanity, I can't quite remember exactly now, but in many of his gangster films, whenever they're having their ornate gangster rituals, he just goes to still shots. He doesn't lavishly, you know, track through the dinner party. He just goes click, 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 done, over. Because he did not, you know, his goal was not to romanticize gangsters. And he had a very different vision that drove his movie making.
With Battles Without Honor and Humanity, is that it's funny that it says humanity in the title, because as you were talking about in terms of the violence, in terms of the stuff that's in the films, I get the feeling this is not someone who relishes violence. This is not someone who wants to portray it because it's fun in some way. It's just This is kind of what happens. And to say that it's almost a humanistic violence would be, I don't know, it sounds like a strange thing to say, but that's almost what I get from it.
Yes. And actually, it's interesting because the one clip from Battles Without Honor and Humanity that I use in my Ampo film, I use about 7 or 8 movie clips in Ampo to portray how many post-war movies were also very much critical of the U.S. military presence in Japan. You know the rape scene in the black market in the opening where the Japanese woman is running through the black market and she's raped? That's actually the only Japanese movie I've ever seen to show that. You know, there's this persistent myth that all American soldiers in occupied Japan were gentlemen, and it is very much not the case. And he was the one director, as far as I know, who had the guts to actually portray that scene.
That's the one thing that I really find interesting about the opening of the first film in the series is that you go from that shot of the still shot of the plane that dropped the bomb cut to the slum, and it's like, this is what happened because of this. He makes a direct connection between those two things.
Well, it's the only movie ever to open with the mushroom cloud, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, usually the mushroom cloud is supposed to be the climax, the big explosion at the end, and he just opens with it. And yes, the implication would be this is a direct result of the bomb. But I think humanistic violence is a very fair assessment.
Well, and I love the confusion in that opening scene, too, where just that mass of bodies and you don't know who's who, and just that, you know, great way of introducing us to all of the different characters and so many characters all at once, too.
Yes. Yeah. That was handheld 65 Panavision.
Wow.
And yeah, exactly. And he said the guy who shot that had carried a really heavy camera in combat. And that was the only reason he was able to shoot that scene like that. So, yes. And the pig's head and the chaos of that opening black market. I mean, you know what? Fukasaku used to talk about the black market shows up a lot in his films. And for him, he sort of has an attachment to the black market because to him it represented the chaos as the possibility for change. And, you know, what he was constantly raging against was here we had this incredible chaos that opened up the possibility for true equality and democracy, and slowly corporate greed and a new kind of hierarchy emerged out of the ashes instead of something that a 15-year-old would imagine to be egalité and fraternité. So, you know, obviously the black markets were a brutal place, but in his eyes, the chaos, you know, represented the possibility for a different, less hierarchical Japan.
The thing that's interesting for me, obviously being an American viewer, is that at this time when Battles comes out, this is around the same time that The Godfather first starts, at least the first two films of the three-part series. And as I've tried
72?
To and as I try to explain to people about Battles who don't know what it is, I say it's kind of like the Japanese Godfather, but it's way better, at least in my estimation. And the I don't know
he
if that's
would be
fair
very
sense.
Happy to hear you say that.
And I just find it like it's so amazing to me that someone could do five films really in about 2 years that are this dense.
Yeah.
And have so much going on and take you from 1945 to like present day and get into all this stuff with politics, get into all this stuff about, you know, sort of humanity and people sort of like changing sides and all the backstabbing that goes on. How does this sort of represent to you? I mean, obviously you grew up in the Japanese culture with your background. When you look at The Godfather, you look at Battles, how do you look at it? Because you sort of have your feet in both worlds.
Well, I think in post-war Japan, there just wasn't much opportunity for romanticizing the gangster life. I mean, and ultimately he was really, I mean, I'm not going to become some film critic about The Godfather suddenly, but it is much more in general, despite the recurring violence, it's a much more serene, established situation. Yes, of course, they're backstabbing, but it's just so much more raw in Fukasaku's vision. But I do think that what is amazing about him is his incredible ability to incorporate politics in the underlying structure of a film. You know, it's like you can look at that and just see a gangster film, or you can read it on a completely different level. I mean, I would actually compare it to, have you guys seen Hunger and Shame? You really should, because Hunger, you know, Hunger is Steve McQueen directing Michael Fassbender, and that film launched Michael Fassbender into being a big star. And in that sense, it's identical with Fukasaku's relationship with Sugawara Bunta, the star of Battles Without Honor and Humanity. And what Fukasaku used to say was, there's nothing more charming than a hungry actor. You know, I think Sugawara may have also been the same age, maybe like late 30s, as Michael Fassbender. And he was like, he just hadn't had that breakthrough film. And Battles became the breakthrough film for him. And but Hunger, and both Hunger and Shame, Hunger is supposedly about the Bobby Sands hunger strike in Ireland. But to me, I just read the whole thing about Abu Ghraib. I read the whole film as a metaphor for Abu Ghraib. And Shame is supposed to be a story about a sex addict, but I see it as a metaphor for monopoly capitalism. And I think that, you know, Fukasaku and Steve McQueen both have this amazing capacity to tell what seems to be a surface story and yet have this rich metaphoric underpinning that allows a much, much metaphorical reading.
Yeah, and it was great watching Bunza in those films because he just, even when he's not the main focus of what's going on, my eye is still completely drawn to him every single time.
Yeah. You know, he was there at Fukusaku's bedside when he passed away, and I was there at Fukusaku's funeral. There were 3,000 people, and there was one American. There was me. And, you know, Sugawara just said how, you know, Saksan is what he used to call him. How could you go before me? And so their bond was a lifelong bond. And, you know, Fukusaku was, when I was invited into the funeral, I was also invited into kind of the inner circle of the viewing of the body, where there were about 200 people. And, you know, most of these kinds of funerals and rituals in Japan are quite staid and somber and quiet and reverent. And I thought I was like in a Moroccan funeral. I mean, there were wailing, people were wailing, people were like clinging to his casket, not wanting to let go. And, you know, I asked one of the younger directors who was, you know, who had been mentored by him, and he just said, you know, that's who Fukusaku was. Nobody wanted to let him go. He was beloved, and he was, you know, perceived to have the wisdom of Solomon. I remember one night being out drinking and with Fukusaku and a bunch of people, and on his right-hand side, he had the screenplay writer, and on the left, the director, and the two of them were in a deep feud. And he just sat in between them, and he said, all right, listen. And he was the one person that everybody would listen to because he had made 60 films and he had figured out a way to survive in the studio system. You know, I don't know if you've seen, do you know the film in which Oshima has a cameo as a cop, as a top cop? In Yakuza Graveyard, Oshima plays like a really fascist cop. And that was Fukusaku's way of saying, you know what, I saw Godard. If I imitate him, I'll be out of a job in a second. But I'm putting Oshima in my film as a fascist cop, just as a nod to that kind of more experimental filmmaking that he wanted to keep on making movies. I mean, for a while in the 70s, he was making 3 movies a year through the studio. And he was, you know, completely happy making 3 movies a year. And so it's not like he didn't know who Godard was. And I think actually in the second Battles film, the Hiroshima one, the last 30 minutes of that film is really quite Godardian. It just kind of goes off on a deep end narratively. But, you know, he was very much aware of what other filmmakers in the world were doing. But he had his niche, and he wanted to keep making movies.
Which is interesting because, as you said, and he did a lot of studio pictures. So the one would say that's process, that's regimentation, that's following the rules. But he was also this iconoclast at the same time. So it's like, how did you sort of see that he was able to balance both of those things, and how does that kind of come out in this film as well?
You know, he figured out a way to make those movies that broke the rules but still made money. I mean, the bottom line is his movies are unbelievably cool and sexy. And so he was able to, in films like Battles Without Honor and Humanity and Yakuza Graveyard, he figured out a way to send out an underlying message of bucking authority while making a really cool, sexy film. I mean, the legend has it that, you know, they used to have all night movie theaters in Tokyo, and that Battles Without Honor and Humanity, part of the reason why it became such a big hit is that college students would watch them sort of all night and then go out in the morning and start demonstrating against the war and against authority. So they were kind of films that rev you up to go out and demonstrate. Maybe Occupy Wall Street people should watch them.
You obviously.
I'm not actually joking.
No, we just did an episode on the film Punishment Park, which was a Peter Watkins film from the early 70s. And Occupy Wall Street folks are watching that as a possible sort of inspirational film.
Uh-huh.
So I can see what you're talking about, and like what I thought was funny with your subtitling of the films, making you real revved up and, you know, want to take on the world. Because I feel that way after watching the Battles box set from time to time. Here in America, there's not a lot of his stuff. I mean, outside of most people know Tora, 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 they might know in the culty circles, maybe like Green Slime, which he did in the late 60s. And then like Battles comes out on DVD maybe 5-6 years ago, really nice box set. Battle Royale hasn't officially been released in the States, but there you can get it. When we think Japanese directors, as you said, you know, we think of people like Kurosawa. It's like that's the name that comes to people's heads. Why do you think we haven't heard as much about Fukuzaku here in the States?
Without naming names, the way that post-war Japanese filmmakers and films were introduced in the United States were, let's go first with films by Kurosawa and Naruse and maybe, who am I thinking, Tokyo Story, Ozu.
Ozu, yeah.
That present a much more, pliant, obedient Japanese vision. And Fukasaku, as I said, what underpinned his filmmaking was rage, and it really didn't fit kind of the American idea, stereotype of who Japanese people were. And so it wasn't until, in fact, I didn't meet him. I only met him because in 1998, the Rotterdam Film Festival had a 15-film retrospective of his work, and I subtitled 5 of his films in a row, 5 that had never been subtitled. And that is what really put him on the world stage. He really had not had any kind of appreciation around the world until that Rotterdam retrospective. And so that's when I think some people started to see some American distributors. And I in particular saw Under the Flag of the Rising Sun and went on kind of a war path to get that film distributed in the United States. And then eventually Home Vision bought the rights. So Home Vision released it, and then they also Home Vision also bought up a good 10 of his gangster films, including Yakuza Graveyard, Graveyard of Honors, State Cops versus Organized Crime, and that Rotterdam retrospective was what brought him to our attention. And of course, it didn't hurt that both Quentin Tarantino and John Woo are ardent fans of his. Although I would have to respectfully say that I think that Quentin Tarantino and John Woo appreciate the superficial violence and don't necessarily get the source of the underlying rage that fuses that violence, that humanistic violence, as you aptly call it.
I'm not going to make any kind of comment on that statement.
I hope I don't get in too much trouble.
No. I mean, I completely agree that Tarantino's violence is very superficial and just stylistic violence that has no kind of real impact on the world, and it's just violence for violence's sake and, just kind of enjoying the bloodletting. So Wu, I would say, has a little bit more going on, but yeah, I don't think that his stuff has nearly the kind of impact that Fukuzaku's stuff has going on. There isn't that rage underneath him. He's very, quiet as a person and very meditative as a filmmaker as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that whether or not Steve McQueen has ever seen a single Fukuzaku film, that I would say that Steve McQueen has much more inherited that style of filmmaking where there's a simmering rage underneath. And it's not like Steve McQueen's movies are so violent, but like I said before, where this, because of the rage, I mean, and in fact, there's a YouTube video going around of Steve McQueen, the only black director surrounded by 9 white male Hollywood directors. And he sort of goes on a little rant about how, like, why don't you guys, like, cast non-white actors? And it's like this deathly silence. Nobody has anything to say. And I think that McQueen shares that kind of, walk into a room and immediately address the 10,000-pound gorilla that Fukuzaku also had.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back. It was great to hear from Linda Hoagland and her reflections on Battles Without Honor and Humanity. If you hadn't had a chance to hear the first part of our interview with her, go back and check out the Battle Royale episode. She has some very interesting things to say about that film, also Fukuzaku's background and career, and also what she sees as how she subtitles films and sort of the art of taking Japanese film and bringing it to an American audience. In case you don't know, Linda Hoagland is one of the foremost subtitlers of Japanese film in the world and has done major work for companies such as Home Vision, which put out the box set for Battles Without Honor and Humanity, and the Criterion Collection as well.
If I may, I want to also mention that Ms. Hoagland is a really accomplished filmmaker, and her latest film, Anpo, is, in my opinion, a must-see, a very very touching look at the art scene as related to, you know, the incidents in World War II, as well as the Anpo Treaty, very much in the vein of what we're talking about right now. So if it comes to your town, go check it out. It's called Anpo.
As we said, Linda Hoagland, we did talk to her on the Battle Royale episode. So you guys, you know, do you see sort of any relation between Battle Royale and Battles Without Honor and Humanity? And if so, how? Maybe yes, maybe no.
Very much so. You know, beyond, of course, the stylistic elements, as we mentioned, you know, the deaths being marked by these sort of title cards or whatever they're called. But beyond the stylistic stuff, yes, very much so. Fukusaku, I think, as I mentioned before, as he was doing with Battles Without Honor and Humanity, was very much channeling some sort of anger. But in the case of Battle Royale, of course, he wasn't channeling so much the anger of his generation, but I think he was trying to channel it into the modern day youth, you know, in regards to their place in society and what society expects of them, you know, in terms of, you know, get a job, you know, join the military, you know, all these kinds of things. But I think that there's a little bit difference because with Battle Royale, he did something I don't think he did so much in Battles Without Honor and Humanity. And I think this point is where you can see how the younger Fukusaku differs from the older Fukusaku in that, as you know, in Battle Royale, there's a great emphasis on friendship. And I think that, you know, the older, possibly more mellow Fukusaku was a lot more cognizant that friendship among the youth, you know, as angry as he thought they should be and as troubled as society tries to portray them as being, I think he saw that friendship was the one thing that they could value over everything else. Whereas in Battles Without Honor and Humanity, there is a sort of friendship that evolves in the narrative arc, but eventually just becomes canceled out by one of the characters. And that character sort of goes on to become sort of what they call a lone wolf. And I think that at the time, Fukusaku was making this nihilistic kind of statement that, you know, you can only really rely on yourself in the world. You know, don't rely on others. But again, through time, I think he saw that no man, as they say, can be his own island, that you need to have those people who you can honestly trust and rely on, and of course help you to survive in the world above everything else in society, you know, that, you know, you shouldn't expect anything of your authorities than them to tell you what to do. But, you know, to have friends, you know, is a great thing. I think that's, you know, that differentiator that really kind of separates the two films, but in a way unifies them as well.
Yep. There you go.
Did I take all the steam out of the room again?
No, I want to add some more steam back into it. I mean, obviously, it's 30 years almost between Battle Royale and Battles Without Honor and Humanity. And I still think that we get the visual touch, you know, we talk about each death being marked in a particular way. I think the violence and the way he handles the violence, this is not fun violence. This is not cartoonish violence.
Oh, no.
Which is interesting when Battle Royale came out, and then a few years later, Tarantino goes, this is my favorite film. This is the movie that I wish I would have made out of all the movies that came out during my time making movies. And it's like, but the problem is, and we talked a little bit about this on the Battle Royale episode, is that violence in a Tarantino film is often cartoonish or taken lightly, while violence within a Fukuzaku film is, and I don't know where I got it, but I talked to Linda about it, where I dubbed it humanistic violence, where this is violence you're going to feel. He makes you sit in it. He makes you squirm with it. He makes you feel each death. This is not just, you know, isn't it fun to kill people for fun's sake?
Right. And I think the violence also very much underlines the drama that's happening between the characters. You know, as I mentioned in the Battle Royale episode, you know, I think I said something like, oh, this film is like a big soap opera. And Battles Without Honor and Humanity, in it, honestly speaking, is also a bit of a soap opera. You know, it's like who's backstabbing who, you know, who's going to get at who for this reason, you know, it's very much like, you know, something you'd watch or your mom would watch probably, you know, midday or something like that. And I think that's what makes it so good, right? I mean, the violence helps underline all that's going on screen, that, you know, there is a permanence or impermanence, I guess you should say, to these going ons in life. You know, it's not just like a matter of these Yakuza just blowing each other away and that's it, you know, like we see in Tarantino style films, but that these are people who have their motivations, and, you know, when people cross them, you know, those people get wiped out. You know, that's you know, that's whatever, that's the law of the world of Yakuza film right there.
We did talk a little bit about this comparison with The Godfather, but I just want to put it out there before the end here that if you like The Godfather and you enjoy Japanese film and you've never seen Battles Without Honor and Humanity, watch these five films. Watch the first set of Battles Without Honor and Humanity, because to me, they make The Godfather look like kindergarten, and even over three films in terms of what Coppola does, he lags, and that third part is just, you could just throw that away. Most people don't even talk about the third part when they talk about The Godfather. They're mostly just talking about the first two films, and that's it, and they don't want to talk about the third movie because they know how bad it is. Well, with this, Battles Without Honor and Humanity, this is five films done over 2 years, and it's quite incredible. In terms of the story, I mean, you might need the flow chart. I know Mike does, it appears. But
yes,
but it's okay. And I'm glad that they put the flow chart in there, because it makes your life that much easier. And I think it makes it a richer experience, too, in a lot of ways, to consult the flow chart from time to time when you're watching this thing.
One thing I want to add in is that besides the main films in this box set in Japan, there were actually four other films that followed. There was the continuation series, which was, I believe, three films. And then after Fukusaku just got so sick and tired of the entire series, he gave it up to another director who did this another film called The Aftermath, which was like, this must have been already early 80s by that time. But so just so everyone knows that there is this sort of continuation, and you can somehow find it if you look in the right places, if you really like the main series.
I haven't seen those, and I didn't know about that basically until about a year ago, that there was this new Battles and all of this stuff. How are those? Have you had a chance to see them, and how do they hold up?
They're of varying quality, and some of them start actually going into basically, what's the word? Basically essentializing what made the original Battles Without Honor and Humanity so good, which is that if you watch a modern Yakuza film, like a direct-to-video film, like some of, like, for example, Miike's earlier films, you know, the Yakuza at that time were already sort of comedic in that, you know, they just walk in the room and blah, 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 you know, and just, you know, kill this guy. So it really essentialized and took out any of the dramatic or metaphoric elements of Battles Without Honor and Humanity, and sort of made it into just another action yelling type of film, you know, that basically does not fit well with the series. So some of them are kind of like that in a way, but again, they're a varying quality, and I think there are some gems even within the ones that aren't so good.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of yelling in these movies. It's not, they're not very, they don't have nice, pleasant conversations very often.
Well, that's Fukusaku, you know, again, showing us that, you know, these Yakuza were not these chivalrous, you know, like, hey, no problem, I'll do this for you type of thing. You know, they were mean, obnoxious jackasses who basically did whatever they wanted to get whatever they wanted.
And talking about this series, you have other people come in who probably pretty well known to people who watch Japanese film. I would say more casual Japanese film. I mean, obviously not you, John. You know more about Japanese film than I'll probably ever will. But you have people like Sonny Chiba come in at one point in the series. Joe Shishido comes in. He's also from Branded to Kill, the Seijun Suzuki film, and stuff like that. So it's nice to see these other people who we've gotten to know in other places come in, and then they become characters within the series as well. So it's an interesting mix as this whole series continues. So we focus mostly on the main film in this episode, but I would say if you see the first one and you're intrigued, it's definitely worth checking out all the way through.
Yeah. And I should also mention that I once checked on the internet and I found a Japanese list of all the actors who had starred in any Battles.Honor Humanity series. And I think as genre film lovers, as your listeners and you guys are really into character actors. And I would say that after looking at this list, at least 2/3 of that list were very prominent Japanese character actors. You know, again, you mentioned Sonny Chiba, Meiko Kaji, Hiroki Matsukata, you know, all these people who were very famous character actors within not only the Yakuza film genre, but as well as other genres that were around during that time, you know, like pink film, well, not so much pink film, but pinky violence films and other exploitation films, as well as the samurai films during that time, etc. So there's a real strong pedigree in this series besides just Fukusaku and Bunta Sugawara.
I was just looking to see if Tamasaburo Wakayama was any of these Battles Without Honor and Humanity, and sure enough,
he was.
1974, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very nice. Yep. So, yeah.
Every character actor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Gosh, yeah. I always enjoy seeing him pop up and stuff, so.
And his characters... if I remember correctly, it's a very interesting character. I think he gets killed in that same episode, though. So,
just one and done, huh?
Yeah.
Very nice.
But I think that a lot of those actors could see that as being like a badge of honor. I was killed in Battles Without Honor and Humanity, you know, like Twilight Zone almost, you know, like that kind of thing. I was in Twilight Zone, you know?
Right. I was killed in the opening of Police Squad.
Yeah.
And we should also probably say, just as kind of a little footnote, and please, you know, guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that it's the soundtrack to the new Battles Without Honor and Humanity that Tarantino used the, I think it's the second track on there, for Kill Bill. And that's just kind of become like this huge runaway hit after he used it in his film. And even though it had been on a soundtrack years and years before, and now you hear and see that song everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's kind of Tarantino's MO, right? I mean, you know, he borrows, I guess, if I can put it nicely, from, you know, other filmmakers and kind of presents it as his own, right? Or people see it as being his, right? So.
Right. Well, it's just kind of neat that he, you know, I mean, the film was known. I mean, that reboot or whatever, that extra chapter of the series was kind of known. And then, you know, it's an amazing soundtrack, though. I really enjoy this. I like the soundtrack actually better than the movie. So, and that's talking about Battles. That's not Kill Bill. So, yep. All right, guys, we're going to take a break and play a clip from next week's show.
I'm sorry, man, but we're closing in 10 minutes.
We have 10 minutes. Does your club sandwich, well, is it made with turkey breast or turkey roll?
Well, it's BLT with turkey, you know.
Breast or roll?
Well, we got the breast, we got the roll, we got the rear.
Bring me the turkey.
Donnie, let me get a club turkey sandwich, one, please.
Yeah.
Would you like anything to drink with that?
No, I do not wish the club sandwich. Would you bring me the turkey, please? The entire carcass. I want to see what I'm getting. White meat, please. All white meat. On 2 pieces of white bread with a lot of mayonnaise and a glass of milk.
Yes, ma'am.
my turkey, white meat, milk, mayonnaise. Okay, there we go. And I didn't forget the mayonnaise.
It's about time.
Well, I had to make it myself.
That was a clip from next week's film, Raw Talent. We're going to be talking with the film's director, writer, and star, along with guest co-host Dion Conflict. We want to thank this week's special guest interview, Linda Hoagland. You can learn more about her through her website. We have a link to hers on ours. As we said before, check out our previous show on Battle Royale. I learned quite a bit about Linda's philosophy on the art of subtitling and her friendship with Fukusaku. It was a great interview, and we want to thank her again for taking the time to talk to us. Also, we want to thank our special guest co-host Coffin John for joining us. What's the latest over at V Cinemacast, sir?
Coincidentally, in our last episode of the podcast, we covered Kenji Fukasaku's Street Mobster, which is the film that came right before A Battle Without Honor and Humanity. So if you want to have a sort of continuation of this sort of talk, go check out our podcast. And, you know, we have, I think that was our 43rd episode. So we have a whole bunch of our back episodes and bonus episodes that you can check out if you've never checked out our podcast before. Also, check out our blog, though, at vcinemashow.com for a little more concise coverage of Asian film. And we have a lot of great reviews as well as exclusive features, interviews, and coming up soon for a lot of your listeners out there, I know who are out there on the East Coast of the United States, we're going to have coverage of the New York Asian Film Festival this year, as we do, what we have done every year for the past few years. We're also going to have ticket giveaways. So if you are in New York or near New York or going to be in town during the New York Asian Film Festival, check out our blog because, you know, you can win some giveaways to some really cool screenings and events that are happening over there during that time. And personally, I'm going to be taking another trip to Japan in another couple months. So I'll be posting some stuff up on our blog about that, probably some film-related things as we try to do with those sort of features. So, yeah, again, vcinemashow.com. We're also on iTunes as well as other ways that you can get the projection booth as well.
Very cool. Yeah, we should also mention, I keep forgetting that we've got tickets to give away to the Detroit Windsor Film Festival. If folks can just drop us a line, they can shoot us an email at theguys@projection-booth.com. First 10 folks that drop us a line who are in the Detroit Windsor area, because it would be kind of silly to drop us a line if you're out in California or New York or any place else. Unless you want to fly in, you can come to the Detroit Windsor International Film Festival and we'll give you some tickets.
And if you do fly in, I'll buy you a drink. So how about that?
There you go. But if you're going to fly in, you might as well fly in and stick around, and you can stay until July 8th, because on July 7th, Rob and I are going to be down at the Corktown Cinema in downtown Detroit, and we're going to be doing a special double feature of Equinox and Mothra with the Corktown Cinema guys. It's going to be a fun time, to be sure.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to it.
And come out and talk to us, because we're going to record our show there. I don't think we're going to do the whole show there, but we'll definitely want to talk to you about what you think of the film and all that fun stuff. Actually, the double feature. So we're going to try and include as much live sound from that big fun event with the Corktown folks as we can into that special episode. Thanks for listening. Once again, make sure to stop by the website, projection-booth.com. We also have a Facebook page out there. You can find that. Leave us some feedback. Also, we love to see your reviews and ratings on iTunes. If you subscribe to us there, that'd be great. It helps us to fight our way out of the slums here and make our way to the top of the projection booth film podcast heap that's out there. And of course, if you really feel the need, okay, maybe send us your pinky, but we're not making any promises if we're going to, you know, pay for the ceremony to have it buried. But anyway, thanks for listening.
Yeah, just make sure the chickens don't get it.
That's right.
これでええんじゃろうか。
そうそう、それで体の重みでいっぺんにおしゃえんよ。
やばー、
しかし意味がないぞ。
何？